Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
When, do you suppose, does 6.5% not really mean 6.5%? How about when the Federal Reserve says so? How about that? The Yellen Fed on the program today. Apple after Steve Jobs as well, and the rise of the robots. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday, today the 18th of March. Great, as always, to have you with us, everybody. Forget the plane for a second. Forget Russia for a minute anyway, and let's do this. Let's talk Federal Reserve monetary policy, shall we? The Fed is meeting this week, today and tomorrow, to be precise. The first meeting presided over by one Janet Yellen. For going on 2 years, the Fed's been saying it's not going to consider raising interest rates until the unemployment rate hits 6.5%. Well, as we sit now at 6.7, there's a whole lot of wondering out there about what exactly is in a number. Here's Marketplace's Adrian Hill.
Imagine you're the Fed. It's the end of 2012, the economy's improving, and you want to calm everyone down. Let them know that interest rates will stay low, really low, for a long time.
So you tell them, look, we are going to keep rates near zero until unemployment gets to 6.5%. And that seems to be like an eternity away.
David Wessel heads the Hutchins Center on Fiscal and Monetary Policy at the Brookings Institution.
Well, now it's March 2014, and unemployment is almost at the 6.5% threshold.
But the Fed isn't ready to bail on those low interest rates. That 6.5% unemployment rate doesn't represent the economic promised land it once did. Victor Lee is an economics professor at Villanova University.
We have to be a little bit careful about what goes into calculating that rate.
The unemployment rate doesn't just drop because a whole lot of people have found new jobs.
It can also go down because of people who are dropping out of the labor force, let's say workers who become discouraged.
Which we know has been happening. Wessel from Brookings thinks the Fed will back off the 6.5% unemployment target.
It's hard to find one number that really describes the unemployment rate and the labor market and what's happening to people dropping out of the job market.
Perhaps we'll see a description of the Fed's economic goals instead of any specific number. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
Not for nothing, but Fed watchers among us, although I'm more of a Fed observer, really. We'll be paying close attention tomorrow. Yellen will be giving her first post-meeting press conference. We will, of course, tell you all about it right here. Same bat time, same bat channel. It will surprise you not at all to learn Russian stocks were up today on the news from over there. Clearly, investors aren't worried about the sanctions imposed by the Obama administration and the European Union yesterday. American companies perhaps are a bit more concerned with billions of dollars in business on the line. Marketplace's Noel King has that story.
Companies with a lot invested in Russia aren't talking much, or they're talking carefully. Boeing didn't feel it was appropriate to comment. GE will only say that it is closely monitoring the situation. Blake Marshall is Senior Vice President with PBN Hill & Knowlton Strategies, a consulting firm that advises companies working in Russia. When it came to naming them, he was careful too.
The American companies are a vast majority of the Fortune 100, and they represent every industry sector across the economy. Aviation and aerospace through consumer goods to energy, telecom, banking and financial services, industrial equipment, agriculture, you name it.
Those companies worry that if the U.S. imposes sanctions that are too tough, European and Asian businesses could take advantage and step in.
It is a global economy, and so it is very easy for certain types of firms to step in and fulfill a role previously played by one of the American companies.
Companies, he says, that have spent the past 20 years building business infrastructure and relationships with Russia. These are also worrying times for American businesses with operations in Crimea. Morgan Williams is president of the U.S.-Ukraine Business Council, a trade association. He says there aren't a huge number of companies.
We know of one private equity company that has an equity investment there in Crimea. Radisson just finished a brand new hotel down there for tourists.
They are facing some big decisions.
If it goes ahead and becomes a part of Russia, they'll have to decide whether they would want to sell or get out, or if you sold and got out, they'd probably be at a loss.
The kind of loss that, in a global economy, seems ever harder to avoid. I'm Noel King for Marketplace.
No losses for the major indices on Wall Street today. We will have the details when we do the numbers. For all the Affordable Care Act deadlines that the White House has let slip, and there have been a bunch, as we all know, the biggest and most unlikely to slide is coming up in less than 2 weeks, March 31st, the date by which the uninsured have to sign up for insurance or pay a penalty. You might call that the end of the beginning of this whole thing, because once the sign-ups are done, the hard part starts. In Camden, New Jersey, where our healthcare correspondent Dan Gorenstein has been spending a lot of time since Obamacare went into effect in October, thousands of Medicaid applications are pouring in every month, creating quite a backlog. So here's Dan with the latest installment of his series, Diagnosis Camden.
How do you get uninsured Americans insured? It's tougher than you may think, with many living hectic lives, unemployment, prepaid mobiles, no reliable address. Even with all the talk about the Affordable Care Act, surveys show 50% of the uninsured don't even know that Medicaid has been expanded.
Just have a seat and I will let them know.
Despite all that, Cooper University Hospital's plan to get their uninsured patients coverage is this: make it as easy as possible.
We just had a family come in who was looking for the insurance navigators.
Like right now, Liz Powell, who works for Cooper University Hospital.
I'll have him sign in. Thank you.
Has just led Edwin Vasquez, his girlfriend, and her daughter into the financial screening office. Back in December, Cooper rigged up their computers so any uninsured patient who came to the hospital or ER would get a call after discharge. That's why Vasquez is here today. He was just in and out of the ER for kidney stones. Vasquez understands he can't afford to go without insurance.
Hopefully, they give me this so that I can be seen and get everything I need and not have to pay out of pocket.
The American Hospital Association says thousands of hospitals are taking similar steps. But Cooper is not only helping Vasquez with insurance, the hospital scheduled him for a primary care visit for free. Like, come to the doctor's office Friday at 3:30 for free. For Cooper, it's a no-brainer. The hospital knows there's a good chance Vasquez would come back for this or something else. And a primary care visit is a whole lot cheaper than another trip to the ER. For Vasquez, he was stunned.
I got hope right now, and I feel blessed to be able to, I feel like they cared when they sent me over here.
Vasquez is right. In the city of Camden, he's one of the lucky ones who's beginning to actually get care. Since October, in the city and surrounding county, more than 9,000 people have applied for Medicaid. Sean Sheeky, the director of the Camden County Board of Social Services, estimated 7,000 people are still waiting. Promise Technology hasn't gotten off the ground, and options are being discussed, but he says there's no immediate solution in sight.
We're struggling a bit, quite frankly. It's a lot of applications. You know, we've not added staffing, and it's presenting a problem.
More or less, there are backlogs everywhere.
That's Matt Salo, who runs the National Association of Medicaid Directors. Salo says since the federal exchange healthcare.gov launched last fall, states have struggled to get the necessary information from Washington. What it means for people trying to get Medicaid? Delays.
You know, there haven't been enough staff or enough funds to pay for overtime to be able to process this backlog as quickly as we'd like.
But there is a workaround. Salo says people must remember Medicaid coverage is retroactive. If you're sick, he says, go to the doctor, go to the hospital, get treatment. And under the Affordable Care Act, it's now much easier for hospitals to get people signed up for Medicaid. Cooper's Dr. Jeff Brenner says actually it's in hospitals' interest to go beyond signing people up.
Knowing that those are Medicaid-eligible patients, it makes sense for hospitals all over the country to go the extra mile and start giving patients primary care even before the cards, you know, arrived in the mail.
Otherwise, the same uninsured patient coming in and out of the ER continues. It's the same old expensive and demoralizing loop. Brenner says getting uninsured patients in the door signals that a hospital cares about patients' health. Often, he says, essential to helping patients care about their own health. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
Even those who couldn't tell Call of Duty 4 from Super Mario Brothers know the video game business is big. The used video game business, also big, somewhere near $2 billion. And that's not just people selling old discs on Craigslist here either. Big global retailers like GameStop make a bunch of money selling used games, which is why the biggest global retailer of them all, Walmart, has decided it wants in on that action. It's offering store credit for old games, which it will eventually turn around and sell itself. Marketplace's Mark Garrison explains the used game market.
There comes a point when a gamer has conquered the criminal underworld of Grand Theft Auto, completed every mission in Call of Duty, and beaten every team in Madden NFL.
This drive now.
Games are pricey and get old fast, so gamers trade them in to afford new ones. And stores make a killing, explains Morningstar analyst Liang Feng.
The market is a very profitable market. GameStop generates around 50% gross margins in the business.
Yes, 50% profit margins. Right now, Madden NFL 25 on PlayStation 4 sells for $60 new. GameStop gives $32.50 in store credit for a used copy, then turns around and sells it for $55.
We've seen other retailers come in, including Target, Best Buy, Amazon, but they haven't really captured significant market share from GameStop just because they've had difficulty offering the same product selection or offering the same prices.
Walmart's power may break GameStop's hold, but even if it doesn't, Walmart's Sarah McKinney points out the retailer could get extra business when people visit to trade in their games.
With almost a billion games sitting and collecting dust, they are sitting on that cash that can be applied to daily necessities and things that they want to treat them to.
Gartner analyst Brian Blau says taking trade-ins gets more people in the store, where they might buy more stuff.
You could just pick up your old games, see what kind of money that Walmart would give you for that. So there's a real value there. And going to a store like Walmart, that's a much more immersive and wide-ranging sort of shopping experience than you do, you know, going into a GameStop.
Not making money in used games? Makers of new games and consoles. Some have tried to stifle the used game market, but they've consistently backed down when gamers have pushed back. I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
Coming up, Apple after.
Steve Jobs not being there changes everything. This is a company that was synonymous with Steve Jobs for so long.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is up 88 points today, about a 0.5%, closed at 16,336. The NASDAQ rose 53 points, 1.25%, ended things at 4,333. The S&P 500 advanced 13 points, almost 0.75%, closed at 1,872. Microsoft clicked up nearly 4% today after announcing plans to launch a version of its Office suite for Apple's iPad. Apple up 0.9%. Hewlett-Packard picked up 3.75% today after Barclays lifted its rating on the computer maker. Video game retailer GameStop down 3.5% today after the Walmart news that Mr. Garrison was just telling us about it. Walmart shares up 0.1%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note down to 2.67%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Wednesday. The House Natural Resources Committee takes a trip to Fresno for a field hearing on California's water crisis. The Federal Reserve wraps up a two-day meeting on interest rates. And 61 years ago, the Oscars were televised for the first time. I'm Michelle Phillippe. I'd like to thank the audio producers, my editor, the digital team. Thank you!
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. After a really big storm, a storm with lots of damage, like Katrina or Sandy, a lot of people's first reaction, politicians and homeowners alike, is to promise to rebuild. A lot of other people's reaction, though, is to say, you know, maybe there are places people simply shouldn't live. Post-Sandy, the state of New Jersey is trying to buy up 1,300 homes in flood zones and knock them down. Easy enough in theory, in practice, a whole different ballgame, as Tracy Samuelson explains from WHYY.
Don Garbusky loves his big open kitchen, new hardwood floors, and the pool out back where his grandkids play in the summer. He's lived in this house nearly 50 years. But in a few months, he'll pack up all his belongings and hand the keys over to the state of New Jersey so they can demolish it.
This doorknob that's broken, I refuse to have it replaced because we're leaving, you know, so why fix it?
So what have you done? It's
just I put duct tape over the piece of crap.
He tells guests not to bother taking their shoes off.
I don't care if somebody comes in with ice skates.
Garbusky has agreed to sell his home to the state as part of its Blue Acres program. It's funded with $300 million of federal Sandy aid to buy out flood-prone homes and tear them down, creating parks or other areas for public use. The goal is to purchase over 1,000 homes, offering owners the pre-storm value of their property. But almost a year and a half after the storm, only 50 deals have closed. The state demolished its first house just last week. One cause of the delay is that Garbusky and many of his neighbors feel they've been lowballed by the state.
Some people made out better than others. Some people, pardon the expression, really got screwed.
Garbusky thinks the offer on his home is at least $20,000 short. Rich Bernazian runs the Blue Acres program. He agreed that some of the appraisals were too low and encouraged homeowners to appeal. But that takes time. And so does negotiating with banks. Bornazian was surprised by the number of homeowners who owe more than their home is worth.
What we didn't expect was the 30% rate of people that were underwater on their mortgage. That's a tough one. The state doesn't have extra money to buy more than the appraised value.
And now the state has to wait for a second round of federal funds to be released before it can make more offers. But the main reason Bornazian says the buyouts are moving slowly is all of the emotion that comes with leaving.
I did everything myself except this boiler.
Ziggy and Mary Dombrowski are in their 80s. They've lived in the house next door to Don Garbusky for nearly 5 decades, and they're proud of the Sandy repairs they did themselves, their bargain furniture finds.
This is from the disaster center. That's from the disaster center.
That TV, I got that from Goodwill. $10.
So unlike their neighbor, Ziggy and Mary have decided to turn down the state's offer. They don't have to sell if they don't want to.
Do I like my place? Love this house. We've been here 49 years. Why would I want to leave now? When we came here, there was only 2 or 3 houses. If they all leave, that's fine with me. I'm used to that. That's the way it was before.
Ziggy says even if the state offered him more money, he still wouldn't sell. In Sayreville, New Jersey, I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
Self magazine tells its readers what foods to eat and what recipes to follow. Now, it's doing the cooking, too. The Condé Nast magazine has launched its own line of frozen meals, which it is selling at grocery stores nationwide. Sally Herships has more on what else is hot in the refrigerated aisle.
Remember when they were called TV dinners?
Originally, they had frozen peas, and then they came out with frozen peas and a butter sauce.
John Stanton teaches food marketing at St. Joseph's University in Philadelphia. He says one thing hasn't changed. At its icy core, frozen food has always been about convenience.
And then they came out with frozen peas in a microwavable pouch.
But Stanton says technology has changed, and so have consumers. We demand a lot more taste from 4 minutes on high in the microwave. And the frozen food industry, according to Stanton, has delivered. It's now worth $37 billion a year in sales.
If the stuff tasted like the 1950 Swanson dinners, you wouldn't have celebrity chefs endorsing them.
Like Wolfgang Puck and Ina Garten. Both have tried to find success on the frozen food aisle. Donnie Chi is a researcher with Euromonitor International. He says some frozen food brands have gone increasingly high-end, but they don't necessarily promote health benefits.
Vegan and actually organic and all that, that no longer qualifies as high-end.
Chi says just organic is so 5 years ago.
They're more expensive, they look better, and they're supposed to taste better. And they do taste better.
Chi says Alexia French fries are one of his favorite fancy frozen foods. But he says Alexia is owned by ConAgra, which also makes Chef Boyardee and Slim Jims. Sochi says the brand must have done some pretty cool marketing to keep its profile so hot on the frozen food aisle. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
It's been a little more than 2 years since Steve Jobs died and his handpicked successor, Tim Cook, took over as CEO of Apple. Jobs wasn't just a CEO, of course. He was Apple personified. And since his death, he has been lionized, scrutinized, and analyzed in books and in movies, while the company he built has grown and has had some problems. Yukari Kane covered Apple for 5 years for The Wall Street Journal. Her book about the company after Steve Jobs is called Haunted Empire. Yukari, good to have you with us.
Thank you very much.
I've been trying to figure out whether this book is about the death of Steve Jobs or the rise of Tim Cook. What do you think?
It's both. It's the transition. I thought that, really in order to understand what's going on today without Steve Jobs, you had to have an idea of how things were while he was alive.
It's pretty clear you believe Tim Cook has failed in the promise he made to Apple employees when he took over as CEO. He said, Apple will not change. I want you to be confident, he said, that Apple is not going to change. Why do you think he has failed?
Well, I don't think he's failed, but I do
you're pretty clear in that he's not delivering on what Apple, once was and maybe will be again. I don't know.
Yeah, and I think, in terms of his promise that Apple will not change, I mean, I think that was an impossible promise. Because Steve Jobs not being there changes everything. This is a company that was synonymous with Steve Jobs for so long, and he's no longer around. So of course, Apple has to change.
Let's talk though measures of success. I mean, it's making money hand over fist. It's got some of the most sought after devices out there. It is by most conventional measures a really, really, really successful company still.
Absolutely. If you're talking about a traditional scale, yeah, I mean, Apple is making a lot of money still, and they could be successful for a long time to come. But if your definition of success is Apple's definition of success, which is to make insanely great products that change the world, well, then you've got a different problem.
Do you think he suffers, Tim Cook does, by comparison with this guy who, even objectively speaking, changed the world?
Yes, that's one of the points that I make in my book is that the challenges that Tim Cook is facing now are challenges that Steve Jobs would have faced anyway. You know, keep in mind that Steve Jobs wanted to run this company like a startup. But when you've gotten as big as Apple, it has its limits. And, I talked to many people who knew both Steve and Tim that speculate that perhaps Steve would have had a harder time running the business the way it needed to be run. I mean, Tim over the past year has had to deal with the overseas cash questions from Congress. Mm-hmm. He ended up having to apologize in China about the warranty, which was the right thing to do. And I don't know that Steve would have been willing to do that.
Steve Jobs was, as we're all aware, a man of no small ego. What do you think he would have thought of the troubles that Tim Cook is having now and the situation Apple finds itself in?
That's a really interesting question. I have talked to people who knew Steve who speculate that part of the reason why he chose Tim Cook was because he knew that Tim Cook would do a good job leading Apple and running the business, but that he knew that he also wasn't going to exceed Steve Jobs at being Steve Jobs. And that his legacy wouldn't be complete until, Apple was seen to fade a little bit.
Do you think he'd be taking a little bit of, pleasure in seeing Tim Cook struggle?
I'm not sure that he would take pleasure, but, I write in my book about the story about the first time that it was announced that Steve had cancer, and the stock fell only 2%, and Steve's reaction was, that's it. And he was very disappointed. So he wouldn't want Tim Cook to do better than he did.
5 years from now, do we still have Apple as we know it today?
I think we already don't have Apple as we know it.
That's a very metaphysical concept on which to go out, but we will. Yukari Kane, her book about Apple after Steve Jobs is called Haunted Empire. Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
The reaction from Tim Cook about this book, by the way, was predictable, but here is what he called it, just so you know. In a statement today, he said, nonsense.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, in which I think the end of days is upon us, a study at the Human-Computer Interaction Lab in Manitoba, Canada, shows that people would perform a task they didn't want to do about half of the time if a robot asked them to do it. In other words, and to take this to its logical conclusion, about half of us will be sold into human slavery when the robots eventually rise up. About half of us are going to lead the resistance. Got to go with what strikes you funny, right? All right, that's Marketplace from APM on this, whatever today is, Tuesday. The Dow up 88 points today, 0.5%. The NASDAQ rose 53 points, 1.25%. The S&P 500 advanced 13 points, almost 0.75%. Nancy Fargali is the senior producer for Special Projects. John Ketchum is the producer on the Wealth and Poverty Desk. Our digital producers are Ariana Tobin and Raghu Manavalan. He gets the credit for the robot final today, by the way. Credit where credit is due. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.